This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It takes two to tango, we know that. How many does it take, though, to do a three-way trade deal, From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 31st of August today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, sometimes economic news, much like history, has a certain symmetry to it. Today is one of those days. This week has been one of those weeks. We started, if you remember, 4 or 5 days ago with Mexico and the United States coming to an agreement on NAFTA 2.0. We end after 3 days of negotiations in that same place. Mexico and the United States agreed. Canada still out in the cold. So that is where we begin today. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. We are left, I should say, just the two of us by the New York City Metropolitan Transportation Authority, but that's a whole other conversation. Lee, how are you?
What else is new? Right? Hi, Kai. Good to be here.
So let's dig right into this NAFTA stuff, the news of the day. Talks between the United States and Canada have concluded, we are told. They reset next Wednesday. Do we think there's any way that Canada walks away from this deal?
Well, you know, they were taking a bit of a harder line, saying we would rather have no deal than a bad deal. Yeah. That was after some comments leaked off the record comments where the president was heard saying that he's not going to compromise at all. So it's been tense. But I do think, you know, Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland just came out and said she really, you know, we're working towards a win-win. When they start saying win-win, you know that kind of maybe there's hope.
But she's been saying that since, you know, 8:30 this morning, L.A. time, right? And meanwhile, you have the president making remarks today at a retirement event. He's saying, you know, we're just going to tariff their cars. And you roll that in with the comments that leaked saying, you know, we're not going to make a deal with Canada, period. One does wonder if the Canadians are now not entirely sanguine that the president is negotiating in good faith.
That's absolutely true. And I do think that they would probably walk away. I mean, there seems to be no reason to think they wouldn't. The only question is how much of that, what the president is saying, is bluster and how much, you know, and this is what's happening inside the room. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is exactly what's taking so long. And I think, you know, I think always the idea of getting a deal done by the end of today was ridiculous after Monday or Tuesday. I mean, that was just very optimistic. So it's definitely going to take more time. So I think that's the only thing we know for sure.
Yeah. But we should also point out here that there's a whole bunch of paperwork that has to be done with Congress, paperwork in the Washington formal treaty sense. But also the idea that Congress and many members of Congress who have districts who do deals with Canada and other parts of the global economy, they are interested in staying in this deal. That has to be pointed out.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of things at work here. We do a whole lot of trade with Canada, and a lot of the sticking points is focused. I mean, Trump has been hammering home this whole dairy issue. Mm-hmm. Canada does have very high dairy tariffs. It's a long-standing, very sensitive issue, but he's using that in a way to sort of paint this picture of all trade with Canada that's very extreme. And so, yes, I think, you know, many people in Congress do, you know, many Americans do want this to go through. This is important.
All right,
it's a big, big market for us.
No, it's a totally huge deal, and a huge chunk of the American economy depends on it. Speaking of the American economy, let me tick off a couple of things here, and then I want your gut check. We had gross domestic product growth revised up this week from 4.1 to 4.2%, so that's a net positive. Inflation, we learned, is where the Fed wants it, right about 2%, so they're going to keep raising rates, but they're generally satisfied. Wages are slowly ticking up. Give me, would you, the Lee Gallagher gut check on where things stand.
All of that is really good, and you're forgetting the other big thing, which is employment, is at this unemployment at a record low.
Right.
And so these are fundamentals. And then corporate profits are very strong. I mean, you could take issue with that, saying that's because of the tax deal, et cetera. But these are all really strong fundamentals. You know, people are saying, you know, the time to get worried is when, I mean, we're just not at that time. I mean, some people are worried, but these are fact-based factors that are positive.
Well, yeah, but you know what? That phrase, the fundamentals of this economy are strong. I'm having a little PTSD here, right? Because, well, you remember back in 2006 and 2007, when the housing market started falling off the table, people in very senior economic positions in the government kept saying the fundamentals of this economy are strong.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got my 2020 glasses on. I'm thinking, really? Even when those housing prices were plummeting? No, it's a good point. And, look, I mean, you know, we have to see what happens with interest rates and, you know, this inflation ticking up is actually important to watch as well. You don't want it to go too high, although, of course, it's taken a very, very long time to get to finally where it is now. So, Kai, I'm going to use that cliche. We just have to wait and see.
Oh, man, I hate that. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine in New York on a Friday afternoon. Lee, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street this Friday. A little bit up, a little bit down before a three-day weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the caveat that investing has downside as well as upside risk, a story now about the government wanting to make it easier for small investors, which is to say individuals, to buy into companies before they go public. That's where a lot of the real money is, money that's usually off limits to those who are inexperienced in the ways of Wall Street. Jay Clayton, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal yesterday that he wants to remove some of the barriers meant to protect small investors. And it turns out the SEC isn't the only one that thinks it's time to take off those training wheels. From WESA Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
Trading stocks isn't what it used to be. It's cheaper, a whole lot cheaper, especially for small investors. E-Trade, Charles Schwab, Betterment, they've all been slashing fees and restrictions in a battle for our business. But this week, JPMorgan Chase bigfooted them all with an app that lets its 60 million customers trade for free.
So they're basically facing threat from two sets of players.
That's Ananya Ghosh, the author of TAP, Unlocking the Mobile Economy. He says for years, big banks didn't want this business and were charging as much as $25 a trade. But now 20 million people are using web-based and mobile trading apps. And the big banks have been lowering their fees to try to catch up.
You know, in a market that's so competitive and is so saturated with, you know, so many options for customers, it just doesn't make sense to have a service that charges, you know, three times or four times what everybody else is charging.
Judith Fox is a professor of consumer law at Notre Dame and was on the board of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau until just a few months ago. She says for small investors, free trading
would be a good thing. Because sometimes it's just prohibitive because the amount of fees, you're not going to get anywhere.
And with a market that seems to know only one direction, up, investing without guardrails doesn't feel that risky. Fox says that could be a problem.
It's almost too easy. And people are going to be doing this who really don't know what they're doing.
Chase says it'll give investors access to its stock research. Joshua Charles is a trader in Rockville, Maryland. He says novice investors may not have the financial knowledge to make sense of it all.
You can go out and you can get great advice online, you know, but if you don't really understand how all that parlays into your bigger picture, you could do something that could actually hinder or hurt yourself in the long run.
Especially if the market takes a turn. Chase has a different big picture in mind. Kelly Kiao heads up digital wealth management at JPMorgan Chase. She says the strategy is to use free trade to pull in people who have Chase accounts and invest elsewhere and to sign up first-time investors.
We know that clients who have more relationships with us and do more things with us, the more that they do, the less likely they are to leave us.
But everybody is in the relationship game. And analysts say J.P. Morgan's free move could force competitors to lower their fees, too. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You know what's a hot investment right now? And no, this is not, repeat, not financial advice. Coffee is hot. The European conglomerate JAB has picked up Peet's and Caribou and Stumptown. Nestle owns a big chunk of the fancy chain Blue Bottle, and it closed a marketing deal with Starbucks not too long ago. Now comes Coca-Cola. It's going to buy the UK's biggest coffee chain, Costa, for a hair over $5 billion American dollars. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains why coffee is all that.
Back in the 1980s, a national trade group for the coffee industry had a contest. Tom Verhaal remembers it. The whole point was to get college students
to come up with ways to kind of make coffee cool.
That's clearly happened. A report from the market research firm Ibis World estimates coffee companies will bring $46.5 billion in revenue in the U.S. alone this year. Verhaal, who's now with the market research firm Global Data, says coffee's become one of the most affordable and pervasive premium goods in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. That's thanks in part to companies like Starbucks and Costa popularizing coffee through the ambiance of coffee shops.
And all of a sudden you have you're not selling coffee necessarily, you're selling an experience.
Costa's got 4,000 coffee shops across the world, including in Asia, where coffee consumption's expected to double by the year 2021, in part because of a growing group of middle-class young professionals. Michael Schaefer with Euromonitor International says Costa's like an espresso shot for Coca-Cola.
It's a powerful branding tool because people are willing to come and spend time and spend money.
The deal gives Costa a chance to think beyond its UK hub, where sales are stagnating. It allows Coca-Cola to capture a ready-made premium coffee brand with global reach. And, says J.J. Keenahan with TD Ameritrade, it gives Coke some new options.
This gets them into the hot beverage market, which allows them opportunities for coffee, hot chocolate, etc. going forward.
The deal is also seen as a potential laboratory for new Coke products. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
College football is upon us this weekend, which will bring talk of crisp fall Saturdays, long-standing rivalries, and money. I mean, it's true, right? Football is economic life for a lot of schools. So how many people go through the turnstiles on game day is a bigger deal than you might think. Rachel Bachman writes on sports for the Wall Street Journal today about how those attendance figures often aren't what they seem. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Kai.
Tell me what's going on here. I mean, numbers have been going down for a while, and in reality, as you report, it's worse than it appears.
It is, actually. What I did was ask schools to report their scanned ticket counts, which are the number of fans who actually show up at the stadium.
Like literally when you get your ticket scanned? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And what I found is that nationwide, on average, only about 71% of the announced attendance, like you see in a box score, is people who have actually showed up with scanned tickets. So, you know, there are many who also include marching bands, concessionaires, wow, ushers, media, people who really never even had a ticket.
Why does this matter?
Well, it matters for a few reasons. One, certainly we want to have honesty in our reporting, and sometimes
yes,
the attendance numbers are a little bit fuzzy. And two, it matters a lot to college athletic departments who still rely on football ticket sales and donations, especially for priority seating, to hold up their athletic departments, even as TV and marketing broadcast rights are skyrocketing.
Right. Also, as you point out in this piece, the television product, as one person says, is so good that, you know, maybe people just don't even need to go to the game.
That's true. A lot of people told me that. Also, interestingly enough, the TV product is one of the things that bothers people at the game because they say there are more delays.
Oh,
and
yeah,
also they can't plan ahead. So, you know, if you want to go to a game that's a 3-hour drive away, you might not know when the kickoff is until a week ahead of time. So
right,
it's very difficult if you have an RV, if you have a long commute, to plan for that big Saturday.
Just Google that. What time is the Super Bowl kickoff thing? And you'll get 1,000 different answers. Talk to me about the big name schools, though, right? I mean, is this an issue at like Alabama Roll Tide, you know?
Even at Alabama, this is an issue. And particularly among students at many prominent schools, they're seeing students show up later or not show up at all. And in fact, at Alabama, soon they'll renovate their football stadium and they're building a student terrace, which they say will be more social and interactive. They're trying to get these students to show up and hang around.
The catch, of course, is that Bryant-Denny Stadium in Tuscaloosa holds like 100-and-something thousand people, so it's tough to fill even on a good day.
It is tough to fill. And that is true, I think, for the larger stadiums. What we're seeing also nationwide is kind of a right-sizing of college stadiums, which really are among the biggest in the world. Many are saying, you know, the era of more is better is over, and they're building suites and kind of lounge areas and fewer actual seats.
What does the NCAA have to say about this, if anything?
You know, they're pretty laissez-faire about it. They do require schools in football's top division to maintain an average rolling two-year attendance of 15,000 minimum. Wow. But most schools can do that. As far as reporting attendance, the NCAA really lets the schools report whatever they want. They take what they give them at face value.
Rachel Bachman, senior sports writer at the Wall Street Journal, talking about football, college football attendance. Rachel, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Coming up,
the whole question of a no-deal exit is a very grisly prospect.
When trade gets gruesome. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On the last Friday of August 2018, Dow Industrials down 22 points. Percentage-wise, basically flat, 25,964. The NASDAQ up 21 points, about a quarter percent, 8,109. S&P 500 unchanged, 29.01. For the week, the Dow added 0.6%. The NASDAQ up more than 2%. S&P 500 up 0.9%. For the month, the Dow up more than 2%. NASDAQ climbed 5.7%. S&P 500 3% to the good. We looked at Coca-Cola stirring up the coffee market with its purchase of the global coffee chain Costa. Coca-Cola spilled off 0.8%. Starbucks sweetened 0.6%. Ford is putting the brakes on plans to import the China-built Focus to the United States. Tariffs, don't you know? Ford sputtered 2.2%. Today, GM slid 0.8%. Fiat Chrysler down about 1.9%. Today, bonds unchanged. Yield on the 10-year T-note still at 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're just a couple of weeks shy of the 10th anniversary of the heart of the financial crisis, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and those moments when we all thought that it was all going to come apart. It didn't, as we know, but it was close. And all year, we've been looking back at the past 10 years in this economy for our project called Divided Decade. And we've been asking you to tell us how the crisis changed you, because it was, after all, the worst economic crisis in most of our lifetimes, but not everyone's lifetime.
10 years ago did remind me of the Depression times. I'm Carmen Woodson. And I was born October 14, 1917, in Beaumont, Texas. In 1932, the Depression was getting bad, and there were people lined up looking for a job, and people were really having a hard time. It was felt with my family. My mother and father at that time reserved one-third of the garden to plant vegetables, tomatoes, string beans, so that my mother had fresh vegetables every day and she didn't have to buy too much. My mother was very good at saving her money and used to sew. And so instead of getting a new dress for us, she would fix the dress. And we thought that there were new dresses. There were times when my mother would be talking with a neighbor or somebody that was going through a hard time and tell us just with her eyes, back there to the other room, so she could talk freely with other people about their problems. I didn't know why my parents were so careful about us children not knowing what was going on around us, but later on, I think I could understand the biggest reason was that they did not want us to suffer in any way or to worry. We always saw girls and boys that were rich boys and girls, you know, and of course we saw life was different with them, but we did not pay any attention to that. We learned to be happy and satisfied with what we had. Since then, it's been a happy life. And so enjoy what you have, and you can live as well and as much as any other person.
We've got pictures of Ms. Woodson on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And even if you're not 100 years old, take a second and share your story with us, would you? Use the hashtag #HowWeChanged. We began with a trade deal that was on the rocks. We end with a trade deal that's on the rocks. Actually, this one's already crashed into the rocks and people are trying to figure out how to pick up the pieces, if I could torture that metaphor just a little bit. Britain and its soon-to-be former European Union partners are meeting in Brussels today to talk Brexit, trying to find some common ground for Britain's future trading relationship with its biggest trading partner. There is a deadline on this thing, March the 29th of next year. And over the past week or so, the British government has really started to get people ready for the possibility of what's being called a no-deal Brexit. And it's trying to play down the potential economic damage. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one from London.
Brexit Minister Dominic Raab has tried to calm fears of a no-deal Brexit. He's promised the Brits that, contrary to some media reports, there will not be food shortages or scarcity of medical supplies, and that their favourite sandwich is not at risk.
So let me assure you that, contrary to one of the wilder claims, you will still be able to enjoy a BLT after Brexit.
Bacon from Denmark, lettuce from Spain and tomatoes from the Netherlands will continue to arrive in the UK, he said, along with the rest of the 30% of the nation's food that comes from continental Europe. A no-deal Brexit, Raab said, would not be a national emergency.
And there are no plans to deploy the army to maintain food supplies.
As he published more than 140 pages of advice to the Brits on how to handle a no-deal Brexit, Raab told the BBC that with or without a deal, the UK would in the long run prosper.
The UK would be better off outside of the EU in any scenario over the long term, but I recognise the risks of the short term.
Nevertheless, those risks do seem rather daunting. Leaving the EU without a new trade relationship could mean a lot more bureaucracy at the border as customs checks are reintroduced. It would be bad news for food imports and exports, claims food industry spokesman Ian Wright.
Fresh produce is going to be massively impacted if there are any delays at the ports. Products will arrive less than fresh on the shelves. The whole question of a no-deal exit is a very grisly prospect.
Many British non-food manufacturers could also be affected. Raw materials and components, as well as finished products, crisscross the border. All that is vulnerable, says Rod McKenzie of the main trucking industry trade group, the Road Haulage Association.
If there is no transition deal, there will be very, very severe disruption to supply chains.
Intangible trade could also be at risk. Insurance contracts taken out with British companies by people or businesses in continental Europe could be rendered invalid if there's no deal. Jonathan De Beer of the Association of British Insurers says millions of people could be impacted.
So the Bank of England estimates that there's around 38 million insurance contracts, around £55 billion worth, which is a lot of customers who are left in legal limbo.
Brexit supporters say all this is designed to scare the Brits into agreeing on an exit deal loaded in the EU's favour. They argue that no deal wouldn't be a disaster. Since the EU has an $80 billion trade surplus with Britain, the bloc will do everything to ensure that its own exporters don't lose out. And if the UK does leave without a deal next March, it would be free to slash duties on imports from any country, giving it a possible edge over the EU. Martin Howe, a pro-Brexit lawyer.
We would be able to cut the costs of our imports on goods across the board by a very considerable level. You're looking at savings in the many billions of pounds a year for British consumers.
The British government does not share his enthusiasm for a no-deal Brexit. It's bending over backwards to secure an agreement. And after today's talks, the Brexit secretary said he's optimistic that a deal is within reach. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. It has been a day of remembrance. John McCain in the Rotunda of the Capitol in Washington. Aretha Franklin at Greater Grace Temple in Detroit. And the Welsh Guards at Buckingham Palace in London, which can only properly be set up by saying the Queen, paying tribute to the Queen. No marketplace angle on that, I get that, but you do kind of have to see the video. British redcoats in those big, tall bearskin hats playing soul as best they could. All right, we got to go. Basically flat pretty much all the way around on Wall Street today. NASDAQ was up about 0.25%. Everything else, Zippo. Our theme music was, that's a technical Wall Street term, Zippo. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good long weekend, everybody. If you get it, if you're working, well, thanks. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.